So what Anne and I are going to present is actually the framing paper, or what will ultimately be the introduction in this volume about the many hands of the state, as we're calling it, which is an effort among the various disciplines, social science and in social science and history, to reflect upon and put in dialogue, really, many of the different strands of research on states and empires that have taken off in the last 10 to 15 years. So our framing paper starts with three paradoxes, which I think are what brought Anne and I to this question in the first place and to wanting to engage in this research. That basically, first of all, what we observe is that it seems to us that there's been intensifying interest in states that has really run parallel to the intensifying forces of globalization. That at precisely the time when there are so many debates about challenges to the state, the erosion of the state, a sense of the decline of the Westphalian view of states as the dominant actor in international relations, precisely that same time you see research on states seeming to take off and really grow in leaps and bounds. And I think if there's a general theme of a lot of this research, it's that the state is not going anywhere anytime soon. It's not disappearing. It's not being eclipsed. But that the scholarship has pushed people to look both below and beyond the nation state and to situate states in international and global and transnational relationships. And so this was something that drew us in immediately in wanting to think more about this research and what was driving it. And a particularly exciting strand here that I was not familiar with until we got into this project is the flourishing research agenda on empires, studied both from the standpoint of the imperialists, the colonizers, and the colonized. And that's something that has become quite important to our project. A second paradox that we observed is that it seemed to us that the focus, the intellectual focus on states, developed most powerfully in U.S. academia. That certainly there have been a lot of interesting intellectual contributions from scholars in other parts of the world, but that U.S.-based scholars have really taken this the furthest. And in part, it seemed to us that this reflected the kind of puzzling and pondering that we in the United States have done about the nature of political authority in our own country. What is the U.S. state? What is this puzzling entity? Be it a mix of strong and weak qualities, if you like that terminology, many people do not. But I think many of us would have a sense about both the kind of capacity and incapacity of the state in the United States, about political institutions more broadly. I think in addition, there is a sense that is especially reflected among some of the historians in our group that the traditional narrative about states, which is highly Eurocentric, didn't fit the US case very well. And that set off a whole interesting research agenda within history about trying to understand the nature of political authority in the United States historically up to the present day. And I think these histories of the US state have proven so rich with theoretical possibilities for studies of states in other parts of the world that one of the things that Anne and I wanted to do was bring that historical research into dialogue, to bring it out from the US case and have scholars studying other parts of the world look at the US and see what lessons could be taken from there. A third paradox, I think, is that after a period of intense intellectual debate about states, about their autonomy and their capabilities, which took off in the 1980s into the 1990s, that in essence, theoretical analyses of states seem to wane at the very time that all these empirical studies were taking off and diversifying. So we spend a good bit of time in our paper giving some of that intellectual background on the movement to bring the state back into the social sciences and history in the 1980s and the 1990s, and I'm not going to go in depth on that because I think that's a familiar history to a lot of us. But I do want to at least point out what was driving scholars in that period and why they felt like the state had to be brought back in. That in essence, many of them were reacting to either the impoverished understanding of political authority present in the field of American politics to some degree, but also were responding to neo-Marxist understandings of the state that were too much dominated by economic structural factors. That these scholars were really trying to recover a role for politics and the primacy of politics, to use the term that Sherry Berman has titled a book with. And so this is what many authors, I think, were trying to do when they were writing about the state and trying to bring the state back in. But in bringing the state back in and developing notions of autonomy and state capacity and strength, I think this spurred a series of quite fraught theoretical debates about the relationship of states to social forces, whether or not they could be truly autonomous and what autonomy really meant, whether or not, as was charged, they had reified the state by turning it into a thing. and what the definition of the state even was or what it should be. So there are a whole series of discussions about this. Ultimately, these theoretical debates seem to trail off by, say, the late 1990s. But the empirical research then just took off another direction. And Anne and I both looked at our bookshelves at one point and saw shelves and shelves of books with the word state in them. But also, we compiled a long list of what we might call the adjectival state, states that have a huge list of adjectives before them. The austerity state, the developmental state, the patriarchal state, the predatory state, the straight state, the taxing state, and we can go on and on and on. We have a paragraph like this. So clearly, there's a lot of scholars out there for whom the state is meaningful, the concept of the state is meaningful, because they're using it all the time. They continue to study it. They continue to use it in their research. And what we wanted to do was really interrogate, what do people mean? What do they mean when they talk about the state? Who do they mean? Who is doing the work of the state? So the goal for our project then, coming out of these three observations, these three paradoxes, well, we have several goals, but first I will just say what we are not doing, which was already alluded to. We are not seeking to provide one overarching definition of the state that we expect everybody to buy into. And it's precisely why we're using this metaphor of the many hands of the state, which was Anne's original metaphor when we were talking about this, picking up from Pierre Bourdieu's highly influential metaphor of the right hand and the left hand of the state, and thinking about different modalities of state intervention and state action. And what we felt and how we got going on this project, it seemed to us that so much research in recent years had sought to unpack what had been a very tightly packed concept initially. There's so much research disaggregating the state into varied functions and organizations and purposes, complicating boundaries between state and society, public and private. So we don't want to go back to a kind of unified Leviathan or unified concept of the state or definition of the state. We want to take into account its many hands and many forms of action. Relatedly, we are not trying to craft a theory of the state, although there is, I think, a lot of interesting theoretical work going on these days, and a lot that could be recovered or rediscovered in social and political theorists of past and present. So I think revisiting some of the classic works of Weber, for instance, rereading some of them, we might see things in there, interpretations of Weber, that are a bit different from the interpretations that we got out of the 1980s and 1990s. But among our group, we found a lot of the scholars have been reaching for other sources, Bourdieu, Foucault, Durkheim, Dewey, all kinds of different theorists from the past. And one could go to the present and think about other interesting theorists, theorists of the patriarchal state, theorists of empire, theorists of colonialism. There are lots of other sources that one could draw upon than Weber in thinking about states and state power and empires. So if we're not trying to craft a unified definition of the state or a theory of the state, I'd say what we want to do instead is bring disparate research communities together in dialogue with each other. To say to students of American politics, get out of American politics, look outside the United States. Comparativists, you live in this country, why don't you think about it as an interesting case? To put in dialogue with your comparative research, state scholars think about empires, empire scholars think about states. So rather than impose a theoretical synthesis around one master theorist, what we, Anne and I, do in this paper is instead attempt to pull out some sort of anchoring insights for the various chapters in what will be the volume that are based on what we think we are getting out of the empirical work. So how do we go about doing this? We basically map out seven clusters of research in the paper. And we analyze each one, we draw out core insights from each one, what they have to say about states, states and empires, but also some potential limitations or intellectual tensions that run through a lot of the research. And we do that not just to be critical, but rather because I think we take seriously just how hard it is to study states, which is why I think we keep coming back to states. If you read Bourdieu's Collège de France lectures on the state, which are going to be coming out in English, I understand, shortly, he's wrestling, you see him wrestling intellectually with what is this thing, the state? How should we talk about this? How should we study this? Dewey also wrestled with what it means to study states and what a state is, and basically says you don't approach it head on, you have to kind of come at it from the side, and you have to keep coming at it, keep rethinking it. It's so hard to study it. Or Philip Abrams, one of my favorite essays, Notes on the Difficulty of Studying the State. It's basically intellectual angst about this very project. So in short, I think when scholars study states, they have to make choices in how they approach a complex subject. And there will inevitably be trade-offs, But the trade-offs themselves, thinking about the trade-offs, what you gain and what you lose, is actually quite illuminating about our object of study. So I will just start in on the clusters and go over two of them, and then I will turn things over to Anne, who will continue. And one of the first clusters we talk about in the paper is the institutionalist turn in research, and how we see that in part as intellectual descendants of bringing the state back in, although it has its own intellectual trajectory as well. But for a number of people who got interested in states, they ultimately turned and got interested in institutions. And we find this is very useful in getting us away from overly aggregated concepts of the state, which was one of the critiques of bringing the state back in. With instead this research looking at the various functions, agencies, and so on that make up states. So, for example, the focus on law as an institution has been, I think, incredibly fruitful and interesting. Or those who study the policy process as bounded by institutional structures have generated all kinds of insights about how institutions matter and how institutions change. So I think this, we would agree this has been a very fruitful area of research, but we think there are some caveats or some limits to what it can tell us about states. And we would caution against an institutionalist view on states that might lose sight of that which makes state institutions distinctive, that the state is not just another garden variety institution. State institutions are not automatically analogous to other institutions. And in fact, we want to kind of recover the original insight of statist accounts, that it's precisely the distillation and concentration of power in states that renders them a distinctive and potent organizational form and makes state institutions different from other institutions. We also don't want to lose sight of the state as a whole. We don't want to reify the state, but we also don't want to lose sight of it in studying bureaucracy A or agency B. And I think one of the merits of all those adjectives attached to states, the carceral state, the neoliberal state, the whole long list, is that they point to the multiple institutional logics often at work that produce particular forms of policy that then have great weight in societies and in polities and in shaping economies and even the geographic landscape. So it's the very power of these state institutions that we want to be drawing attention back to. A second cluster of literature that has been very fruitful and just keeps going, I keep thinking we're at the end of it, but there's always new contributions to it, is the literature on state formation, state building, which I think the large literature on this, growing out of the 1980s statist accounts, reflected the weight of Charles Tilly and the whole enterprise and how he motivated so many people to study this interesting question of where states come from. And there's such a rich and interesting literature that has developed out of this, that has made many contributions. For one, drawing attention to states as the powerful institutions of our time and thinking about how and why they emerged. But we also find it useful in making us probe how boundaries got laid down, how boundaries were made or have been unmade. Geographic boundaries, boundaries between public and private. When you're studying processes of state formation, you're forced to think about how those boundaries get put down. So if there's a limitation in this literature that we identify is that we feel there's been an awful lot of emphasis in the state building literature on material elements of state building, on the imposition of administrative power over the geographic terrain. That we, taking a page from Bourdieu, who took a page from others like Durkheim, would argue that states monopolize not just the use of physical force, but also symbolic force. That states are powerful not just because they prevent exit or coerce compliance, but also because they manufacture categories, standards, and principles of economic and social and political organization. So to understand how states come into being, how they are made and endure, it's not only about thinking about their material power and how that develops, but also how they produce, to paraphrase Abrams in one of my favorite quotes, a managed construction of belief about the state that binds subjects into their own subjection. And we think some of the other approaches in the clusters that we will talk about can help us think about how that occurs. I will pass it over to Anne.
All right. So I'm picking up with this last point about the need to shift into thinking about culture, symbolic power, and the relationship to violence. And in some ways, I'm not sure this is a cluster as much as an insight or a set of premises that really pervades so much of the work on the state that it, it may have a particular status among our clusters. So the cultural turns in sociology and history and the constructivist turn in political science have shaped views of the state as a social, cultural, and ideological construction. And this makes us scrutinize the narratives that state officials and their analysts produce about legitimacy, sovereignty, disinterestedness, and coherence, for instance, as a set of cultural or ideological products that should be analyzed for what they tell us about both states and the worlds that bring them into being. And here, Bourdieu's lectures are quite useful in providing a way of thinking about some of these cultural productions and their mystifying character, where Bourdieu says, the state is this well-founded illusion. This mysterious reality exists through its effects and by the collective belief in its existence, which is the principle of its effect. And he goes on and encourages people to maintain a skepticism about the state's narratives, including those put out by scholars who study states. But so if we think of the state as a cultural force, one that distills the dominant values and beliefs of a society while also helping to produce them, I think that gives us a different and richer view of the state than might have been present in the kind of high moment of bringing the state back in. But we think that the state as ideational or cultural construct also can't stand on its own. When agents of the state show up at your doorstep to tax, conscript, detain, interrogate, incarcerate, or kill you, as Christian is fond of reminding us, they're not operating solely in the realm of myth. Contemporary states command scholarly attention because they represent a concentration of coercive power and control that's startling, awe-inspiring, and not infrequently horrible. Facets of state power which are absent from some rather bloodless constructivist accounts. But we think we don't want to just go back to the view of states as deploying violence, although obviously that's one of the things that's going on. But the interesting question is really how the physical and symbolic violence are interlinked or mutually constitutive. And I think this is a trend that we see across scholarship, which seems quite a good one to us, and one that I think most of our contributors are following in various ways. Now, another cluster, which again, I'm not sure so much cluster or set of premises, relates to states, empires, and the transnational or global turn. States emerged out of international and global dynamics, and they continue to both shape and be shaped by them. Initial work in the mid-80s and on emphasized the Janus-faced nature of states vis-a-vis the international arena and the domestic sphere. And this was one of the insights that was thought to give the state a certain kind of autonomy, is that it had this Janus-faced structure. States necessarily were situated within larger divisions of power. And more these include in people's conceptualizations imperial relationships and global divisions of labor. Globalization and the growing international and supranational organizational architecture have only intensified the need to cast our visions both below and beyond the nation state. Obviously, viewing states as isolated and fully independent units is not tenable. So returning to empire, to use George Steinmetz's term, George isn't with us at this conference, but he's been one of the contributors to the project, is one prominent strand of work which is taking up the challenges presented by globalization and by the complexity of relations between the West and the rest over the centuries of their contact, conflict, and exchanges. This research has developed the initial second wave insights that states were embedded in global context. And if, you know, casting our eyes back to that era, the world system of states in the Hinsian-Weberian approach, or the world system in Wallerstein's continually influential but economically determinist version, while also drawing on the impulses to examine politics from the point of view of the oppressed. And I think much of the work that was done in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s on revolutions and national liberation struggles against colonial and imperial powers, and on the resistance of people of color against white racial supremacy across the globe, has also infused this kind of scholarship with a certain kind of motivation. I think now we face the challenge of how to conceptualize different forms of empire's domination, territorial versus non-territorial, for instance, as one way to go about that. But we've become convinced by our colleagues who've been working on empires that there are deeper conceptual linkages between states and empires. Definitions of empire, a centralized hierarchical system of rule acquired and maintained by coercion through which a core territory dominates peripheral territories, for instance. This is from the Empire Strikes Back mode. Or relationships of political control imposed by some political societies over the effective sovereignty of other political societies, as Michael Doyle puts it, bear more than a passing resemblance to many definitions of states. And one of the things that came out of our earlier discussion was this very interesting comparison of the way that state building, which required a projection of power over hostile hinterlands inhabited by supposedly backward or even barbarian people, looks a lot like the way that imperialism is understood. And so we start to think, along with Julia Adams and her sometime collaborator Steve Pinkus, that European state formation in all cases was a thoroughly imperial project in the modern period. There are differences in the degree of imperial control and different ways in which ideological and material power intermix, but I think we can still recognize that there is a phenomenon of imperialistic state building or state building as imperialism that we need to attend to. Another piece of this terrain that has been striking to many of us is the way that the colonial rule of difference has been replicated in a number of different sites, both within the US state, for instance, and across global North and South today. So we think that these insights from the study of empires have been really crucial. I'm not sure that we have a caveat about this. I don't think we've written about it, but so maybe we're just too new to the arena to recognize where we want to urge caution, and we'll count on our colleagues who are going to be talking about empires on Saturday afternoon to do some of that cautionary work. Now let me turn to the cluster on states and representative institutions, which represents our colleagues who are coming after us, their work and the work of others. We thought that a fundamental ambiguity of second wave historical and historical, sociological, and political science literature was how to think about the state apparatus vis-a-vis representative institutions of democratic polities. And there was definitely some ambiguity in the discussions when, to some extent, autonomy was being framed as the opposite of having popular representative control going on in the polity. So we want to ask, are legislative branches, ruling parties, and democratically elected executives part of the state? So people were initially saying no and focusing mainly on the bureaucratic capabilities of countries like France, Sweden, or Japan, where there was this insulation. And putting the problem of state building in the US in terms of the project of forging bureaucratic autonomy in a polity which was very porous and fragmented and subject to the whim of electoral politics. Now, this seems to be quite a problematic way of conceiving democracy and the state, and I think the discussions in the next panel will be bringing up some of the problems and the ways forward, but I think that the main impulse in the newer work is to think about how democracy actually forges a certain kind of state power rather than being somehow state power separated from democracy. So we want to have a rethink about both the cases that were cast as strong bureaucratic states like Prussia or France, or the counterexamples like Britain and the US, which would sometimes get called weak states, and of course they were busy projecting power across the world and so on, and this seems a rather problematic way to think of them as weak states, as Bill Novak has pointed out in earlier work. Novak describes U.S. governing arrangements as a distinctly new kind of coercive power emerging within popular sovereignties. So I think this is a good insight that we have, and we're now, I think, struggling with, well, how do we then bring this insight into our catalog of different kinds of states and make sense of that? I suppose that if there is a risk here, it may be of overemphasizing the strength of civil society and the power of self-rule while neglecting that which was also baked into the American experience of state policies on the ground by those subject to them. That we're thinking about things like subnational authoritarianism, slaveholding, later Jim Crow, that this was part of what was going on with the U.S. So how do we bring that into dialogue with these insights about the productive power? Thanks. Okay. Another cluster or approach that we have looked at might be called implementing states. It's a way that I think many scholars, particularly in sociology, have tried to move away from an overly abstract categorization of the state to look at the concrete ways in which states actually do the work of governing, what states do, and what kind of mixes there are on the ground. We can think about both non-state actors and their complicated interrelationships with state officials. We can think about frontline officials of the state and what they're actually doing, the street level bureaucracy kind of insight. And we think that there's a very exciting development in ethnographic sociology in particular, which has long been preoccupied with micro-level social processes, is a turn to the examinations of, quote, institutions such as the police, justice, and prison as sites of articulation between public policies and discourses and agents' everyday practices. This is Didier Fassin. But, it's an impulse that Armando Laramian and others have pursued, is looking at what the state does to ground our notions of what the state is and possible contradictions across levels of states. We think that you can also get a purchase on the complicated interrelations between public and private by examining implementation of different policies by the state, and we have some wonderful papers that do this, that talk about the possible, the kaleidoscopic number of possibilities of ways that different agents can work together to pursue state projects, but with very different modalities. Liz uses the metaphor of digits to complement our many hands. We do want, however, to insist that we need to continue to make the distinction between the state and other modalities in some way, or we're worried that we'll lose sight of it entirely. Now, the final cluster I want to talk about is states and social stratification, or inequality states of various sorts. This has been a particularly rich area of research, and it's not simply the insight that state actors often seek to define, classify, standardize, measure the world so that the world can be better mastered and remade, but also that states and popular groups exist in some kind of tension in terms of how these inequalities get produced or remade or perhaps even pushed back. And there are some really fascinating essays in our group that look at moments of transformation between, say, states that at one point were segregationist states or patriarchal states, and it seems like maybe, to some extent, there's been a turning around from that, some transformation towards what Des King and Rob Lieberman call a civil rights state, or I might call a gender-neutral state. And I think this question of how states actually stratify and can states be a force towards undoing inequalities is one that will preoccupy us. In terms of the risks, I think it draws on the other insights that we've been talking about in the sense that, is it the whole state that is doing these particular kinds of stratifying, or are there pieces of the state that have one stratification project and other pieces that have another. So then you're talking about a struggle within the state as well as within societies over these political stakes. Now, a final, I don't know if it's a cluster or a premise, is the issue of whether we ought to find ourselves a new dominant French intellectual theorist to follow in studying the state. You know, we're past Chuck and Theta. Where are we now? Some people want to campaign for Bourdieu or others. Kim and I have decided that we're pagans and that we like to draw on a number of people. This has a feminist impulse in it as well as a pagan one, since so many of the theorists who are invoked are male, although Theta obviously is not and has an interesting place in the firmament of theory gods, I guess, or goddesses that you could say. In any event, we think that the intellectual gods are not so different from us, and they provide different resources and inspirations that we can conjure with as we try to cope on the earthly plane of states and empires, the people and the powerful, and we, the scholarly interpreters of theirs, of these struggles. So just a couple of anchoring observations and then I'll finish. And we're drawing this from what we've read and reread from all of you. And I'm not sure where this is gonna go, where we're gonna take these observations, we'll have to see. So states are institutions, but they're more than that. Central to our understanding is that states are enduring. They're reasonably routinized, they're path-dependent entities, but states are more than bundles of institutions because of their claim to speak on behalf of a collectivity, whether this happens democratically or some other way, and because of their claims to recognition in the international arena. And of course, that's one of the distinctive issues that we don't want to lose sight of. As I said, the premise about symbolic and material power seems quite significant to us. That states distill and use both forms of power. And some of the way that this works is through the pull that they have on public consciousness, on the constitution of subjects. So we're very far away from a notion of citizens and subjects where utility maximizing individuals satisfy their goals, but a much more recursive process in which states are helping to constitute citizens. States work through varied and often very complex modes of governance. And I think perhaps today I was, you know, reminded as we were thinking about the complexity that we're seeing out of the papers, these really interesting interpenetrations of public and private and levels and so on, that it brought me back to Tilly's The Formation of National States in Western Europe and that Middle Age period, which he describes as having all these weird to us forms of sovereignty and overlapping claims and so on. Well, maybe we're in another period like that. And I think it is imperative for us to try to pull that apart analytically and figure out what's going on, how the Escher print works. We don't want to dissolve the notion of public and private so much as to really interrogate how it gets built. And then finally, the notion of the Janus face state continues to give us a lot of analytic purchase for thinking about states and their place in the global arena. We don't think states are being eclipsed, but they are being enmeshed in forces operating both below and beyond state boundaries. So the study of empires here, I think, is quite critical in helping us think about how states have been and continue to be situated in global contexts, including how international power relations enduringly shape states in various locations in the globe. And we will come to a fuller conclusion, we hope, at the end of this project. Thank you.